Let me make this statement nice and clear for everybody in words of one syllable. Never in the history of South Africa did any white man from anywhere, I'll repeat, any white man from anywhere ever enslave any indigenous black man from South Africa. Period. Period. Never. It's almost like they have turned savagery into a religion. And that's what's now happening in South Africa. It seems as though those people attacking farmers to drive them off their land are competing to see who can be more savage. Why is it necessary to assault farmers' wives with hot clothed irons? Why is it necessary to put elderly people's feet in boiling water? Why is it necessary to drown children in boiling water? That's what's happening.
Finally, I have the mini shockwave stun gun and pepper spray combo available directly. These powerful defense devices are incredibly small size. It's an ace up your sleeve for self-protection. It doesn't pop up on x-rays and scanners, so you can conceivably take it places most weapons can't go. Self-defense should never be complicated, and the mini shockwave and pepper spray combo are very easy to use. I plan on making sure every woman in my family has one of these, and any teenager, boy or girl, should be carrying these around as well. If you feel that they're safe and can handle these with all the problems going on in this world, I would want my loved ones to be as protected as possible. Together, they're only $29.99. See the link below for this amazing deal.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. This episode, I have Dr. Harry Boyens coming to the program. He is originally from South Africa. All of his ancestors and everywhere is from South Africa. And he wrote an incredibly deeply rich book on the history of South Africa. And he is coming on this program to talk about how that history parallels with the United States, and what's going on in the United States now was really what happened, what he believes was a precursor in South Africa. And he's going to explain that. First, he's going to explain South Africa and what the true history was as far as who was there originally, when the Dutch came, and who was there when the Dutch came. And then he's going to start talking about the white farmers that are being murdered and brutally, savagely murdered. And he's going to talk about that. Our media is covering it up and spinning it like it's not any big deal. It's not any bigger deal than the normal violence that's there. And that's not true. And he explains that. And he talks about why they want their land and what they mean by that. And then he stays after for my patrons to talk about some of the true history with Mandela, who he really was. And you'll be surprised that he wasn't an MLK, you know, Martin Luther King type character here. He was more like Malcolm X on steroids. I mean, way off. He was a terrorist. He was considered a terrorist. But he's going to say from his own words what he was. And then he's going to talk about a little bit about Robert Kennedy and some of the quotes that he had. Very interesting. That's my patrons. I have a link below. But let's get into my interview now with Dr. Harry Boyens. Hi, Harry. Thank you so much for joining the program.
It's my pleasure to be here.
You have amazing research that you've done. Wayne Jett and others have referred me to you saying you've come up with this 1,200-page book on the history of South Africa, which is something that people don't understand. And British England colonized it like they did the United States back 1500s, and you're going to explain this. And then what happened to, you know, some of the current situations, how that ties into what's going on today. Can you start with why you decided to even research this?
Well, just as a background there, I was born in South Africa. I lived there for 47 years. So I have a fair idea of the place, lived through much of the troubles. But what precipitated me into writing this book, which is 630 pages, by the way, the guys get a little excited when they refer to it. It is huge, but it's not 1,200.
He said
It's
1,200, so I was,
630.
whoo, okay.
What happened is when these farm murders that folks have started hearing about, when that started happening and got out of hand around about 2006, I thought, hang on a second, this is not going to stand. I got to do something. And I thought, since I'm a physicist, I have a research background, I deal with patents and stuff like that. I'm used to working with lawyers and evidence. I know how to express the story in proper Queen's English. I know how to gather the evidence. Why don't I just start from a side and every time my lips move, I provide evidence? So I thought I should put that together and explain to folks the background of South Africa. What it was, what it is, what it's become, and what is the message that holds, particularly for the United States, because they're through history.
Because you believe that the United States, this is a sign of what could happen here. And I cut you off, so go ahead.
Yes, it's not so much a sign as in certain things are being directly exported to you, and I can prove it. So the issue for me is, someone had to do something, and why don't I just put the evidence on paper? Because I felt at the time that we're heading for the death of a nation. If we're then all gone, I'm going to make sure that some piece of paper remains that incriminates the rest of the world for having done nothing.
Well, that's fair, I would say. That's what this whole point of the show is to try to get some out there and then figure out solutions and ways that we can protect ourselves. So,
Can I
go
put it to you
ahead.
like this?
Yes.
The particularly the Afrikaner, the equivalent of the Amerikaner, the American, in South Africa, the guys who've been there since 1652, they're very religious folks. They typically Protestant Christians, and they believe in turning the other cheek. They believe in not carrying a heart full of hatred, all that kind of good stuff. But ultimately, someone has to put the truth out there. It's no good that they just go down quietly. And my argument is, I'm going to make noise about this. I'm not going to have a genocide happen on my watch.
And you're worried that the white farmers and landholders will be mass slaughtered.
No, I don't think they'll be mass slaughtered. I think they are simply going to get murdered until they vacate their farms, until they remove from those parts of the world where they have lived for hundreds of years, and that's going to be it. And ultimately, folks are going to be reduced to poverty simply because they're white. It's that blunt. So you're going to have to forgive me during the course of this session if I use the words black and white. I did not choose them. I'm one of those guys who voted for a new South Africa in 1994. I was stupid enough to believe the Mandela dream. Well, I stand duly corrected, and I will now use the words of the government down there, namely black and white.
Okay, so because that's how they speak down there.
That's how they speak down there.
So, people in context, we're not used to it here because we have
I
a lot
know.
of, well, we're really trying to integrate. Good people are trying to integrate and just look at people as people and not look at skin color. But down there's a whole nother deal going on. Now,
Yes.
when Britain came originally, how many people are English background or white? Caucasian versus the original people that were there who are black. Because when you hear South Africa, a lot of people just think, well, that was all black territory.
Well, would you allow me to start at the beginning and give
Yes.
you like a thumbnail sketch of the history,
Yes, that's what I'm,
the extent
yes.
that it can fit on a thumbnail? First of all, the first European settlers in South Africa landed at Cape Town in 1652. That's pretty far back. Now, you can take me as a almost disgustingly representative example of the so-called Afrikaners. My DNA mix is exactly the average, the typical. There's no average for that stuff. And here's the bit that folks don't seem to understand, particularly in the United States. I think the Brits understand it to some degree. That's why they're more culpable. Now, the thing is, here I sit. My first European ancestor, specifically European ancestor, arrived in 1657 in that country. He was one of the first 20 men to be given to have his contract to be freed from his contract to work for the Dutch East India Company, and was given a piece of land in October of 1657. So since then, there have been European descended farmers in South Africa, 1657. The proclamation for that was made around February of that year, February or April. Forgive me, I don't have it quite right. So he was my first European ancestor, but he was not my first foreign ancestor in the country. Again, I'm quite typical. My first non-African ancestor in that country was an Indian woman who was a slave in the employ of a Dutch guy in Jakarta in Indonesia. The Dutch, like the British, had a policy of, as they put it, don't bring the merchandise home, as disgusting as that sounds. And therefore, when they went back to Holland, he sold his household slave at the Cape. And so that was actually my wife's first ancestor from not from Africa in that place. Mine was a Indian convict lady. She'd killed her husband by hitting him with a hay trestle because he'd abused her. So the judge had to sentence her, and he decided, given the abuse, he would banish her to the worst place the Dutch knew of in the world, which was the Cape of Good Hope. So that was my first foreign ancestor in South Africa, was an Indian slave lady. But my original first ancestor was a little Khoi girl. Now, the Khoi are not black people. Folks need to understand that. They were the first original inhabitants of that part of the world. They're called Khoi. They used to be called the Hottentot. That word is considered derogatory these days, so we all talk about Khoi people. So my little ancestor was a teenage girl. She was made the interpreter for the commander at the Cape. My imported slave lady became a washerwoman for that commander, and my first European ancestor was the first guy to farm there.
Do you have
Okay, now
pictures
all
by chance
pictures
of
of
your
not
ancestors that I could put up or of the Khoi
no, not
people?
back then. No, unfortunately, I don't. I mean, there was no way that anybody was going to take,
Sure,
create
yeah.
a picture of those days. But I do have a description.
In keeping with my promise to provide the absolute best products I can find that I take personally and would give my family, I'm really excited to show you their Advanced NMN, which has been proven to dramatically increase your energy and much more. As discussed in multiple shows with Ken Schwartz and Cliff High, NAD is a great supplement to enhance C60's effectiveness, but even on its own, NMN can pass through cell membranes and join with other NMNs to then convert into NAD+, making it much more effective than other NAD supplements on their own. NAD and NMN has been scientifically shown to increase DNA repair in cells. It has also been shown to promote the creation of new mitochondria that can replace our old mitochondria, and it can also increase the removal of damaged mitochondria in our cells. It maintains stem cells' usefulness and ability to regenerate. It also has been shown to reverse age-associated expression of genes involved with inflammation. It does this and a lot more, and it does this at an affordable price of $37.95. Click on the link below to find scientific studies and to learn more about this amazing product.
Amazingly, a French guy visited the Cape and actually met my Khoi ancestor. And he said that, I need to remember the words. He says something like, "She's white like our European women, and pretty, and her nose is a little flat." That's how he put it. So I have this description by a French guy who went on to be rather famous. And that's what I got, okay? So, and if you go and look at my DNA makeup, you'll find that it is, again, representative of the white Afrikaner of South Africa. It's about 40% Dutch, about 30% German, about 25% French, and 5% everything else you can imagine. And in fact, I do have a black African slave ancestor. The DNA test says from West Africa, and so does the recorded history. I've got all my ancestors back to the 1650s. It's like thousands of people. So I've done all that. I had to do all that homework to write this book. So I know exactly where I come from. I know exactly how I'm made up, and the DNA test confirm it.
Well, how many, what was the makeup when the British came there to settle that country, colonize? What was the makeup of the people that were there at that time? You were saying the Khoi, were they the ones that were there, or was there tribes? I mean, who was there?
Okay, so let's take a look at this when the Dutch landed in 1652, if you'll allow me that. The nearest black people, nearest true black African people, were 700 miles away at a river called the Mtamvuna, which is the southern border of what is now the Natal, KwaZulu-Natal province. I think that's something like the distance from probably New York to Savannah or something. So that's pretty far away. You can measure it another way. It took 50 years before the first white man met the first black man overland in that country. And both were parties far in an advance, position-wise, of their own people. It took 130 years before white and black first clashed. That should tell you something. So there was a whole history before black people got into the picture. Now, the people that the Dutch dealt with in that area were the Khoi, but in 1713, something terribly, terribly bad happened. A ship arrived at the Cape. It was serviced as usual. The washing went to the washer people, all that kind of stuff. These ships were at sea for 4 months. And it turned out the thing was infested with smallpox, and the Khoi people had pretty much zero resistance to it. The descriptions of what happened are horrific, and it got completely out of hand. They got so scared that if one lot tried to flee to another, the guys they were heading to would simply kill them because they were scared of this thing. Nobody understood what germs were or bacteria or anything. So they would actually kill one another to try and avoid this stuff. And there are descriptions of the entire Cape smelling of death. So by the later 1700s, the Khoi had effectively ceased to exist as a culture in its own right. And you had a sort of a polyglot population at the Cape of European people, typically Dutch, with a lot of company employees and ex-company employees who were often Danes and Germans. And then you had some remnant Khoi people. And then you had an imported slave population, which was largely from Indonesia and places like that. Many of them freed slaves who elected to be there.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
When you were doing your research on the smallpox, one thing that I learned about the United States here is that smallpox came and it killed people, like you said, it started by accident, but then they purposely gave it to the Native Americans because they wanted to colonize and wipe them out. Did any of your research find that there was any kind of purposeful use of smallpox or weaponized?
Not at all, but you're quite correct. And that little episode that the British perpetrated in North America is pretty awful, because they were good enough to leave us a record of their thoughts, and it's all on paper, and I quote that in the book. But there was no need to. There was no war. There was no reason for anybody to try and exterminate the Khoi people. For what reason on earth would they do that? They're not a particularly warlike people.
Yeah, you were all getting along, and there was no issues.
No, I'm not going to say anything that folks were totally getting along. I think the Khoi people were treated. I think the Khoi people were treated unfairly. But much of that happened after the Brits got there. I'll give you an example. The Brits arrived in 1795. At that point, there's a little bit of a preamble to that. During your War of Independence, Cape Town actually played a major role, because whoever controlled Cape Town would control the high seas of the world in the 17 during your revolutionary period, and the French and the British both rushed for the Cape, but the French actually beat the British. They shot them up pretty badly on the way there, and took the Cape. And since they now had control, they could make sure that they protected you guys against the British Navy. Without the British Navy, the British on land in North America was kind of stranded and unsupplied. And that's how you won the war. That's the strategic reason for winning the war. Okay? So the Brits were never going to make that same mistake again. And when hostilities broke out with the French again in the 1790s, the first thing the Brits did is they made a beeline for the Cape of Good Hope with a letter in their pocket from the Dutch stadtholder, as he was called, the king. And that letter, basically, which they had coerced out of him, basically said, please hand over the colony to the British. They promised to give it back when the war is over. And so the governor at the Cape had no connection with Europe. The ship was the fastest way. So when the Brits arrived, there's this guy with a message that says, hi, I'm English. Please give me your colony. And so the governor resisted. The Brits attacked and took the place by force. The very first British commander put it on record that he thought nothing would intimidate these Boers, as he called them, in the interior. That would be my ancestors, who had by then settled as farmers all over the place. Nothing would intimidate them more than an army, as he put it, of Hottentots in the pay of the British, and that he had already taken action to do that. Can you imagine what would have happened in the United States, or I should say America at the time, what would have happened in America if the British governor had told his masters in England, I would like to create a Six Nations army to keep these white settlers in check? That's what we're talking
they
about.
They would go, yeah.
That's what we're talking about. Now, when you do that, you get trouble. You want to know where the troubles come from? That's where they come from.
Well, people trying to oppress and control others. That's what goes on all the time.
Yeah.
So this is the history of England coming over now, the British trying to control and take over the control of South Africa.
Yeah.
From that point on, did they have control of it?
They had control until about 1803, when there was a temporary peace with Napoleon. They then actually did give the Cape back to the Dutch, who reappeared. Now it was the Napoleonic Dutch who appeared at the Cape for a total, I think, of just 3 years. And in 1806, Napoleon having gone to war again, what happened is this time the British arrived with 60 warships and a massive army, and they meant to take it for permanent and for good. So they came back, another battle, took the place, kicked the Dutch out, and ever since then, the Cape has been British. But at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, 1814, at that point, the Brits and the Dutch made a deal in which the Dutch basically sold us along with a place to the British for something like 30, I think, £35 a head per ancestor. You can imagine what that feels like. That was less than the going rate for a British slave, by the way.
So they sold you as a commodity, all the people on the colony. Why did they have
I'm not going to say they sold us as a commodity. They sold the place and the people They sold the place. But how's a bunch of Texans going to go back to Switzerland? You know, let me put it that way. So these guys are stuck at the southern tip of Africa. How the hell are they supposed to get away from there? So they're there and they come with a colony, and the British paid a sum of, I think, like 30 million pounds or something. I can't remember the exact number they paid, but when you divide in the number of people, it boils down to they sold the place for around 35 pounds sterling a head. Okay. And from then on, the Cape was British. It never changed hands again. And they never really saw the Afrikaner as one of themselves. We were subjects. We were treated as British subjects. We were not British citizens.
Well, did they, because they sold, when they bought, did they feel like they purchased you with the land? Or did they feel like they just purchased the land and then you came along with it?
I think it's the second one. In all honesty, I think they purchased the place because it was strategic. And along with it came these unfortunate Boers that are stuck at that place. You know, what are we going to do with these creatures? You know, we hate them. They're there. We'll have to tolerate them. That I think that was the attitude. Because there's another factor that comes into the picture in the 1780s that I would particularly like to get to, because I think that's the monster that's stalking the United States now.
Yeah, please tell us.
Well, there was a it was all precipitated by a water spout on the River Meuse in Europe, but I'll tell you about that a bit later. I was wondering, I have to find a little note that I have here so that I don't mess up this quote so that you can appreciate it. Got to get this gentleman's name just right. Back in the 1700s, mid-1700s, you had the French philosophers who developed a philosophy which the British, not they, the French never used these words, but the British called it the noble savage. And in 1782, a young man, a Frenchman by the name of Lavaillant, was traveling the frontier region of the Cape. And he was a very strong adherent of this philosophy. And I would like you to hear what he wrote in his own book back then, translated into English by some Brit just a little bit later. He says, and don't tell me you don't perceive this today, in every part where the natives live entirely unconnected with the whites, his words, not mine, the whites, their manners are mild and amiable. Well, he doesn't know it, but he's lying. They were killing one another by the thousands and hundreds of thousands. Anyway, their manners are mild and amiable. On the contrary, an acquaintance with Europeans alters and corrupts their natural character, which amazingly, he admits it's amazingly, which amazingly degenerates, and this remark, which is a melancholy truth, seldom admits of exception. And other words, anybody else is perfect in nature, they're wonderful, nice people, it's just that when they meet a white man, they suddenly turn into Frankenstein. Okay. And you can't tell me you don't pick that up in your own media today.
Well, I think there's a lot of anger towards white people for their privilege, and then I think there's a big backlash. Backlash is pretty, there, we do have a history of discrimination in this country, you know, with the black and the white and things, but I think the
Yes.
laws have really evened out, and I think most people are really trying to be just see everybody as who they are, but there's a big
That's my
backlash.
experience.
Yeah, there's a big
That is
backlash
my
going on.
experience in the United States. That is, that's partly one of the reasons why I'm telling my American friends, will you please stop using the phrase African American? The black folks I know in America, and quite frankly, let it be known that I play in a band, and I play in a band along with a bass guitarist who is a black American. Okay? So I know the folks. They are not, African Americans. They are black Americans. I wish this African American thing would stop because since Canada is part of the continent of America, and I come from Africa, I'm actually the African American. Somebody's trying to steal my title.
That makes sense to me. I can appreciate that because the Africans are quite a bit different. You know, if I suppose if you
Yes.
move here from the Somalians, they call themselves Somalian, but they would be technically, if they become American, they'd be African American, right? Because they moved from Africa.
Way closer. Yeah.
Yes. Well, but you know, Africa's
It
such a huge continent, and that's we kind of get confused there. That's why I wanted to make a set of what really was in South Africa, because South Africa is different than other places. I mean, you have a Middle Eastern type, that's part of
Yes.
Africa. You have, you know, Nigeria and what we think of Africa. And then you have South Africa, which is more like a European kind of.
Well, in the far north of Africa, you have people who are basically Arab descendant.
Yes.
Mixed in with them are other groups of earlier stature over there, and there's too many to go into that. When you get to Ethiopia and especially to Somalia, you have people who happen to have a black skin color, but if you want to tell a Somalian that he's African, you're looking for trouble. They don't like being called Africans, okay? They are a Cushite people. And historically, they held black Africans as slaves. When you get to the center of Africa, there are still pygmies in the forest. To the west of Africa, you have true Negro people. To the east of them, you have Negroid people. The Bantu people of South Africa are not Negroes, they're Negroid.
What's that difference?
You put them next to each other. You take a person from Senegal. And you stick him next to somebody from Kenya, you'd have to be completely blind not to see the difference.
They're just different
They
genetics.
lighter. They lighter. They the Bantu people are lighter in color. They're more brown than black. They're typically not as tall, etc. With the exception of one group, the Tutsi. Sorry, I got something wrong there. But anyway. And then when you get to the southern tip of Africa, you've got the Khoi people who are small and spindly and quite light colored, and amongst them the San Bushmen, who are, I don't know if you ever saw a movie called The Gods Must Be Crazy. Well, those are the San Bushmen. They're small people. I get a picture of my 10-year-old son standing next to a full-grown Bushman woman. And they prefer to be called Bushmen. They don't like the word son. The politically correct folks tried so hard and unfortunately developed a word that the Bushmen themselves consider derogatory. That's what happens from too much political correctness. You put your foot in it. Africa is a huge place. I wonder if I could ask you to run the first graphic that I produced. It would be image one. It's a map of the place, which might help.
Okay, I'll put that up right now.
Alrighty, folks should be seeing a picture, a graphic of the southern tip of Africa there. And the first thing that one should notice is the red arrow and the blue arrow. The red arrow is a warm sea current, the Mozambique Current that flows on the eastern side of the country in the Indian Ocean. The Blue Arrow is a very cold current that comes up from the South Pole, basically. And what that does is it makes, just like with the United States, it makes a desert on the west and it makes subtropical on the east. And all of the history in the end goes back to that reality. The rainfall obviously is higher on the east than in the west. And that dotted green line is a best approximation to a smooth curve through the 350 millimeter summer rainfall line. Forgive me, in the end, I'm a scientist. I'm a physicist. I tend to work with graphs and numbers and things, okay? And I fit curves to things. I analyze things. I do that with history as well. Now, that green line, that 350 millimeter summer rain, if you get any farmers watching this show today, they will recognize that that's more or less what they need for serious grass. And if you want to keep cattle, you want serious grass. And the thing is, the people of Eastern and Southern Africa, their entire culture is based on cattle, on milk, more specifically the milk. Yes, they do grow a little patch of corn here and there for own consumption, but that's a subsistence activity. Fundamentally, historically, they are cattle herders. Now, there is a spine of mountains that runs like a horseshoe around the country, and I trust folks can see that. In the west of the country, those mountains are not particularly high. They may be 6,000 foot. I think the highest peak's about 7,000. But in the east of the country, they go to 12,000. Those are serious mountains. And we can get to a picture of that I've taken of that. Now, those eastern mountains carry snow every winter, heavy snow. And always remember, look at where the Tropic of Capricorn is, right? Your entire country is outside the tropics. Tropic of Capricorn, I think, runs somewhere south of Miami. Of Tropic of Cancer. For us, this very southern tip, most of South Africa, is actually outside the tropics. You see that? We are the equivalent in the we are in the southern hemisphere, the equivalent of Mexico in the northern hemisphere, very roughly. So you turn Mexico upside down, you get a rough approximation, then you stretch it wide so the deserts get worse.
And Mexico's very warm.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So the folks in Nevada and southern New Mexico, southern Arizona, they would recognize South Africa that went there. In fact, in places, they look identical and they even smell identical, okay? The dust that does it. Now, you see a number of brownish arrows that I drew there. That's the direction that the black people of South Africa came. They came down from the Lake Victoria area, and in all of their verbal oral histories, they will tell you that. That's where they originally come from. Now, here's the first. I've already told you, you know, that what my DNA makeup is. I've already told you when we arrived there. What I didn't tell you is that the present president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, he is a Venda. You see that middle arrow that has Venda written on it? They arrived in South Africa almost at pretty much the exact same time as where the Dutch arrived at the Cape. Just so as you know. But they weren't the first black people. In honesty, about my book is about facts and about evidence, and the evidence is that there were black people there earlier. It's just these black people that arrived late. Okay? Tswana and Sotho people that you see marked on there were there earlier. But they were more or less at the spots that I indicate with the arrowheads. And at the bottom right of the drawing, you see the location of the coastal black people. That and the term for them is Bantu. It simply means black people in their own language. Ba means people and Tu means black. So they were more or less at that river, which is the Mtamvuna River, the southern end of what is now the Natal province. That they were in 1652. So that would be the ancestors of people like Nelson Mandela, the coastal black people. You can view the people, the black people of South Africa, as being two huge groups, three huge groups, two big ones and a small one. The Venda are the smallest. They're fewer than a million, I think, at this stage. And there's the Sotho's in the interior, and there are the Nguni people, as they're called, N-G-U-N-I, the Nguni people who came down the subtropical coastline. So the Nguni people are wet country people. Sotho people are drier country people, dry tropical bush versus verdant coastal forest kind of people. And that's it. But west of that semi-desert line, if you were to look at the pictures that I have, I have a specific picture that I was wondering if you could show, image 2B, which will contrast the west with the east for you. Okay, so in that picture, image 2B, it shows the west. That's the countryside where my father grew up. That's what the west of the country looks like, the interior of the west. Right along the coast, just like in California, there's some rain along the coast, but they don't have the huge mountains you have that bring a lot more rain or cause a lot more rain. So it's the highest rainfall spot in South Africa in that zone is actually the Cape Town area, the interior from Cape Town, in the mountains. But as soon as you're beyond those mountains, you've got semi-desert. You're into Arizona, New Mexico, and worse. The east of the country, as you can see, gets more than 350 millimeters of rain, more typically more than 500 in most of those parts, and lovely green countryside. And it's one of the enduring frustrations for me that during the bad old apartheid days, the world media would go hysterical about these black homelands, which were in that area, in that green area, were such a dumping ground, and it's a horrible desert, a human wasteland. I don't know all the terrible phrases they used. These days, the very same people, with their lattes in tow, travel en masse to that same area because such a beautiful countryside, they can't get enough of it. Nobody asks why there's this disconnection. They're either lying now that they can see it, or the media was lying back then. One of the two. Someone was lying. Anyway, so you can imagine a country that has this green line running through it that says, basically wet to the east and dry to the west, but as you go straight up into the north, even the wet part becomes eventually a desert, the Kalahari Desert. And that is where you found those little sun people who were in the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy.
The Bushmen. Okay, so you were saying that the president's people came to South Africa what year?
Around 1650.
About 1650.
And those are not my words. Those are the words of the missionaries who served there.
Okay. And what year did did your ancestors get there?
1652.
Okay,
my
the same
own
time.
Physical ancestors?
Yes.
No, my own. Yeah, 1657 was my own personal first ancestor there.
Okay, around the same time frame. Okay. And so now.
So same era. But remember, I did tell you that along the coast, the other black people were there definitely much earlier. Deep in the interior, the Tswana people were definitely there much earlier.
Okay. Well, and did your ancestors live for a long time, the farmers, just peacefully coexisting, doing your land and farming and so forth? Or was there a lot of oppression, as we are told?
First of all, I think you have to differentiate between the Khoi people and the black people. The white folks ran into the black people in serious fashion around 1780. It was a simple clash of civilizations. the milk-based black culture to the east, and the farmers with cattle basically for meat to the west. It's not a case like the US where black people were imported as slaves. It's a case of there were white people there and there were black people there, and they had finally met in their two expansions, one lot expanding west, the other lot expanding east. So there wasn't anything about so-called oppression at that point. What there was is, starting in about the 1790s, as military clashes between the two lot. That's rather different from the American experience. So this is the first thing I'd like to get across, is folks need to understand that in South Africa, well, if the United States has a history that bedevils it, that was based on master and slave, South Africa has a history that bedevils it, that was based on a clash of two civilizations. Those are different things altogether.
It's viewed very differently, too, in the minds of the people that are, right? There wasn't a slave culture there.
There were slaves that were imported. Let me make this statement nice and clear for everybody, in words of one syllable. Never in the history of South Africa did any white man from anywhere, I'll repeat, any white man from anywhere, ever enslave any indigenous black man from South Africa. Period. Never.